Welcome to Inside Analog Photo. I'm your host, Scott Shepard. The Inside Analog Photo radio program is all about the traditional photographic process. We talk about all aspects of analog photography, including the hybrid workflow. You can find out more information over at www.insideanalogphoto.com. And of course, Inside Analog Photo is brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful. These guys have the coolest instant photography materials known to mankind. They have, of course, the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4x5, color and black and white. They have the Instax systems in the wide format, the Instax 210 camera and film, and of course the Instax Mini in the Instax Mini 7 and the Instax Mini 25, both in color film. Beautiful stuff. There's nothing cooler than instant photography. You get a print, because if you don't have a print, you don't have a real photograph. This is great fun stuff. This is great for art. This is great for business. This is cool stuff. You definitely want to check them out over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends over at Photo Publicist, providing worldwide publicity, strategic promotion, social media marketing, and business development for the photographer, turning photographers into celebrities. You can find out more information over at www.photopublicist.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab for the highest quality work known to mankind anywhere on this planet. Unbelievable developing, scanning, and of course, output on high quality Fuji Crystal Archive. Unbelievable cool stuff these guys are up to. And remember, you don't have a photograph unless you have a print in your hand, and you need to print your pictures. This is important. You need to supply proofs to your customers and even print your own work, because it's not about looking at it on a monitor. It's about holding a print in your hand. Definitely check these guys out at Richard Photo Lab, of course, at richardphotolab.com. Our friends over at DR5. DR5 Chrome Black and White Developing, that turns your black and white neg into, that's right, black and white chrome. Unbelievable stuff. www.dr5.com. Our friends over at Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. For the camera strap that will not slip off your shoulder, guaranteed bar none, the coolest strap around. Our friends at Iger Studios. For the finest quality drum scans known to mankind, Iger Studios. Our official media partner, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, for all things traditional photographic process on the web, www.apug.org. And our official philanthropic partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, over at www.eastmanhouse.org. Today on Inside Analog Photo, we're going to have with us the legendary Ron Mowry. Ron's going to join us to talk about fixers. In our last conversation on development of developers, today we're going to talk about the development of fixers, what they are, why you need them, how you can make new ones, what Ron's up to, and a lot of great stuff. This man is a pinnacle of information. Unbelievable. He's achieved over 15,000 posts now on APUG. All he wants to do is share this knowledge he has, and that's why they call him Photo Engineer. This man knows a lot of stuff. I wouldn't say everything, darn close to it. So this is going to be a great interview. Of course, our buddy Ron Mowry, cool stuff. You can find out all of what he's doing over at APUG, www.apug.org. Ron, how you doing today, buddy?
Just fine, Scott. How you doing?
Good, buddy. Thanks for joining us back here on the program. Great to have you on Inside Analog Photo today. And in our previous conversation, we talked about developer. Today, we're going to chat about fixer, our next evolution in our chat here. So, Ron, why don't you tell everybody here that's not familiar with development of their film, let's talk about fixer. What is a fixer? Why do I need fixer? And then we'll move from there.
Okay. Well, after you develop an image, you have a mixture of silver metal and silver halide left in the film. You have to get rid of the silver halide, or once you turn on the lights, the film or the paper will start to darken up, turn purplish black, and you'll lose your image. The only way to make an image permanent is to remove the excess silver halide. And one of the best ways of doing that is a chemical solution, typically called a fixer. It fixes the image. The use of HIPO was discovered, I guess, in about 1820, something like that, by, I can't remember offhand, Herschel. Anyhow, it's based around a chemical called thiosulfate. This is a negatively charged ion that's paired usually with sodium or ammonium ion. And it dissolves silver halide by forming what's called a complex. The funny thing is that there's not just one complex of silver halide with HIPO. there are many of them, and some of them are not soluble. Some of them are very slowly dissolved, and so on and so forth. So you have to be very careful to get the thiosulfate concentration exactly where it should be to give you the optimum fixing rate and dilution and removal of the fixer from the silver halide from the coating, both during the fixation step and in the wash afterwards. So a fixer is a lot more complex than most people think. For example, I can point out to you a fixer formula which would appear to fix, and it's very dilute. But actually what it's doing is dissolving the silver halide, but it's not moving it out of the coating because it's not soluble enough. And so you go into the wash, and the hypo-silver mixture is still in the coating. Coating looks clear, and you say, hey, I'm home free, and you turn on the lights, and you wash it, and the coating very gradually deteriorates over a period of years. It's slow, but it does. It deteriorates. So fixer is something that is much more complex and has to be designed to be within a certain concentration limit, or it doesn't work. I guess that's basically where I'm coming from. And people that dilute their fixers way down or make them way concentrated to work faster, they go off into the weeds.
So okay? Either way, so you have this envelope of the right concentration, the right levels that do it correctly. And if it's too much or not enough, then you have problems both ways.
Yes. And these, actually, the revised edition, has some very excellent graphs and charts showing how this can go against you. In particular, I made a note to myself here to refer you to page 713 for a list of possible complexes and their solubilities, and page 719, which shows you a graph of sodium and ammonium hypofixation and the optimum point that you should be at. Basically, you can really mess up a fix if you go below 100 grams per liter or above about 600 grams per liter with ammonium hypo. You can actually slow them down so badly that they don't fix right, or that they can form insoluble complexes.
Well, yeah, an insoluble complex is not good because then it won't leave the emulsion.
Right. Now, the only way to prove to yourself that you've done good fixing and good washing is to use the retained silver test, which is basically just sodium sulfide in water. And if you put a drop of it on the edge of a print or film, it will turn black or dark brown if you retain silver. The other one is a retained hypo test, which is silver nitrate in acetic acid, and you put a drop of it on, and if you've retained hypo, the white area on a print or a piece of film will turn light brown. It should do that immediately, because if you let it sit in the light, it'll turn brown anyhow. But just drop it on, it'll turn brown. So those are the two primary tests that will tell you if your workflow is proper with a fixer. Now, I'll go a little bit further and say that there are three basic classes of fixers. There are acidic fixers, neutral fixers, and alkaline fixers. And they all have their place. The more alkaline the fix, the longer the shelf life. The more acidic the fix, the more easily you can add hardeners to it or make it harden the coating if you need to. That's sometimes necessary. They each have their own advantages and disadvantages.
With this fixer, Ron, this would be applicable across the board for any kind of film, color, black and white. We're not going to talk about Kodachrome because it's in its own little world. But for traditional products that are available to consumers these days, black and white and color, the fixers are very similar?
Yes, they are, with one minor exception. Color fixers have to have a much narrower pH range. They're usually near neutral because an extreme in pH range can affect dye. So you try to leave a color material at around the neutral pH just because of the dyes. Other than that, any fixer is good for black and white, and any neutral fixer is good for color.
And we have the same thing with fixers as we do with developers, so there's 16 ways a Sunday to get to the same end product?
Yes, there is. Let's take a trivial example of hydroquinone and metol in a developer. They act together to give you faster development. Well, it turns out that thiosulfate mixed with ammonia gives you faster fixation. So you have the same types of interactions between different chemicals, yes, but the same type of interaction where you can double, triple, quadruple, or really extend the rate of fixation. The one warning that I would put out there for everyone is that if you want to really kill fixation, put potassium into the fixer. every textbook agrees on the fact that potassium thiosulfate, or any potassium in a fixer, will slow down the fixation rate by at least an order of magnitude, if not completely poison a fixer. People have asked me, though, Scott, how does ammonia work with thiosulfate? What other things will work? And let me explain to you that if you imagine your emulsion as a sponge and hypo as a golf ball, you're trying to push a golf ball through that sponge, and when it meets a silver halide molecule, several of these thiosulfates are going to try and glom on to that silver halide, and then they're going to try and drift out of that sponge surrounding it. So it's not a fast reaction, especially since it's associated with the sodium ion. But if you go to the ammonium ion, which is, say, maybe 20% smaller than sodium, they say, well, okay, maybe that size will help. But there's something else going on, too. Let's say that three or four or five sulfates want to hook on to one silver. In the case of ammonium fixers, a couple of those thiosulfates are kicked off and replaced by a tiny ammonium. So instead of having five golf balls around the silver, you may have one golf ball and three BBs. Do you see the difference in size?
Sure, big difference.
Okay, so the ammonia, not only being the silver halide complexing agent, replaces thiosulfate and improves the diffusion rate. And so ammonium fixers are much faster than sodium fixers. Let's see, another thing that you should look at is the fact that you can't make an aldehyde-based, a formalin-based fixer using ammonia because the aldehydes react with the ammonium ion. So you have to use alum. So once you say, I want to have an ammonia fixer, I want to have a fast one, but I want it to be a hardening fixer, then you're automatically restricted to an acid pH. And so you see, there are all kinds of design considerations go in to making a good fixer. You have to decide what chemicals you want to put in, what do you want them to do, so on and so forth. So if I wanted an alkaline fixer that hardened, it would probably have to use something like zirconium sulfate, Zircotan, or something like that. It couldn't use alum because alum will precipitate in alkaline solution. And it could use formalin if there was no ammonia presence. So there are all those design considerations. Now I can go on and say that there are a lot of other ways to increase the fixing rate. I've already mentioned on APUG that my Superfix formula, Superfix 1, is posted there by a member, and it uses thiourea. Thiourea works with ammonium hypo to give an even greater boost to fixation rate. All of the reasons aren't known, but it's certainly disclosed in a number of patents, as is the use of thiocyanate. You can add swelling agents to fixers. So you can make an acid fixer that swells an emulsion just like an alkaline fixer does. I don't know why no one has thought of that, but basically, yes, you can make an acid fixer and make it swell the emulsion just like an alkaline fixer as described in Haste. So the field is wide open, but people seem to be trivializing it.
Ron, why do you find that people think this is a trivial process of designing of a correct type of fixer and using other types of things that don't really work correctly? Why are people doing this?
Well, first off, it's very simple to just take a handful of sodium thiosulfate crystals out of a bin and throw it into water, and it does fix. There you are. So people think it's simple. Why do I need all that other stuff? Well, you need it to prevent decomposition. You need it to prevent sludge formation. You need it to help keep the fixer active as it seasons in. So people think it's simple because the concentration is not that critical. As it turns out, about a handful of sodium thiosulfate pentahydrate in a liter of water is just about right to make a perfect fix. And two or three handsful in a gallon of water would be just about right for another bigger batch of perfect fix. Comes out to be about neutral pH. It comes out to be right in the middle of some of the best figures for fixation. And you can get it cheap at a swimming pool supply house. You just don't know what the other crud is in it. It may only be 90% pure, so it may not have a long lifetime or anything like that. That's something that might be good to bring up here. The lifetime of a fixer. When a fixer goes bad, it starts to smell like rotten eggs, and or it starts to get cloudy. Now, when people find a fixer doing one or the other of those, sometimes they keep using it. Here's the problem. Let's say you're taking 35-millimeter pictures, and your fixer's a little bit cloudy, and I'll go back to my wet sponge analogy and say that those little cloudy particles are actually getting into your emulsion, and they're hard to wash out. And once you dry it down, they're in there for good. And as a result, when you enlarge them, you're going to get little tiny white spots on your prints that make you feel as if your picture is grainy, and it's really not. You may think it's dirty. Well, it is in a way. It's the precipitated decomposition products, mostly sulfur, that take place when fixer goes bad. So one of the worst things you can do is use a bad fixer, hoping that it's going to work for you, because you have a reasonably high statistical chance of ruining small format negatives. The problem isn't so bad as the format size goes up, because these particles tend to be extremely tiny and only show up when you enlarge. Anyhow, that's just a thought.
Do you find, Ron, that through the whole process of developing and fixing and doing your own photographic development work, that probably the most important thing would be the fixer then?
Well, it's certainly the thing that lends your picture permanence. Without a fixer, we would essentially have no permanent pictures. They'd just fade away in a couple of days' time in daylight. Even in dark, they'd probably darken up, even with an excellent wash. Before they discovered the use of hypo and applied it to photography, that was one of the biggest laments among the photographers, was having truly permanent images. As I said, Herschel was the first one to describe it, but it wasn't until about 50 years later that they really started to apply it to photography. And I guess that was when photography started to take off and was the early breakthrough in photography for the common citizen.
So let's chat about this fixer that you've developed, and where do things look like moving forward in regards to fixer development? I'm assuming you're probably always working on something, but what have you seen in the whole industry in regards to trying to make this process better?
Well, TF5 has just come out via the formulary. I guess it's been out since around Christmas time, maybe a little bit before. It is the replacement or successor or logical extension to TF4. Bill Troop and I worked for about 2 years on it. And basically, it's an odorless version of TF4. It does not have any of the sludge in it, and that's about it. It works almost identical to TF4. We also have Super Universal Fix, which is still under development. I guess we're on formula number 8 or 9. I forget the count of it. Samples of that have been sent to a couple of photographers with glowing reports. The problem is that some of the ingredients are extremely costly. But basically, Super Universal Fix will accelerate fix rates by about 30%, if I remember the figures, and it will accelerate the wash rate by about 30%, maybe as much as 50%. It does depend on water supply. So the tentative instructions for that say you must test your workflow and water supply for fix rate and wash rate. But basically, Super Universal Fix has been trade-trialed and gotten good reports and is now waiting to see if we can get the cost down. We may have to reformulate and go for Super Fix 10, because doing this is expensive, difficult, and people want the fix to be less expensive.
So there's my question. Let's chat about the quality of the fix and what I'm going to gain versus being cheap. So with these extra components that are costly, what am I picking up over using something that's less expensive, per se?
That's a very good question, Scott, and that's why we are questioning the release of SuperFix. Do you gain, if you can wash for half the time? That doesn't mean too much here in Rochester, where I've got Lake Ontario sitting a mile north of me. But it means a lot to somebody in the desert, down in Nevada or Arizona. You see the difference? So maybe people in one place are more willing to pay for it than others. We don't know yet, and we don't know how much they're willing to pay. So some of this is still up in the air.
Do you find, Ron, anymore that people even care about print permanence and negative permanence, that a lot of people these days are just shooting and scanning, and it doesn't really matter what happens after that?
Well, that's too difficult a question to answer. There's no simple answer to it, Scott. You've got the whole gamut of people who are all analog for their film and digital for their print. And the other end of the gamut is all digital, or all analog. And then you've got every shade in between. Obviously, you've got a mix of museum people saying that digital prints are archival, but it's well known that they're not. It's just that to them, they feel that they've got the digital original, the JPEG, and they can print it out anytime they want to. But they're forgetting that 10 years from now, nobody can read the Microsoft FAT file system. It may be so totally obsolete, or NTFS might become obsolete, and they use something entirely different. So there you go. You've got all your JPEG images, and you can't read them on a computer that exists in the year 2050, which is when your prints start to fade. You see what I'm saying? But you've got all of your negatives. So you can print them any way you want to. You can scan them with existing scanners then, or you can print them directly if you can get photographic materials, analog type. The problem is that analog print materials are starting to disappear, and film scanners are becoming more and more difficult to find. People are scanning prints into other prints, but they're not scanning as many negatives or transparencies. There have been a couple of complaints there. But what do I want in a fixer, though? I want an economy fixer. I want it to have a long shelf life unmixed. I want it to have a long shelf life mixed. And I want it to have high capacity. Those are the things that I strive for. And then along with it, it should have low toxicity. That is, no toxic chemicals, so on and so forth. And that's why Superfix 1 never was realized beyond the posting, because it contains thiourea, which is a registered carcinogen in California. It's just that the human body produces thiourea to a small extent, and so do many wildflowers. So is California going to ban them too? So I've taken the approach, reformulate it such that it works with low toxicity chemistry as well.
So how would you test when you're developing a fixer that you actually truly have dissolved all of the silver halide out of the layers and that it's truly been fixed correctly? What kind of process do you have to go through to test this stuff?
All right. The testing procedure that I use is to make a series of prints and then process them such that they have different times in the fixer, like 10, 20, 40, 60, 80, 100, and so forth seconds. And I have a whole stack of these prints. They're put into the wash and washed for a constant length of time. And then each one of them is tested with the retained hypo test and the retained silver test. And then I lay them out and I say, this is the optimum fix time beneath or below which you should not go. Then another set is run with that fix time, and I run a 10, 20, 40, 60, 80, and so forth second wash time, and test them with the retained silver and retained hypo test. And I say, this is the minimum wash time that's acceptable. After I finish the wash and the fix series and have the minimum acceptable fix time at normal wash and the minimum acceptable wash at normal fix, then I hold those prints all stapled together in a batch and put them in a normal storage place, which is a moderately illuminated dark light cycle in an office area next to my darkroom. And I keep them for 6 months or more and see if there's any change to my evaluation of what that time should be due to the keeping factor. Generally, there isn't. So that's the way the print material is tested. The film is tested similar to that. This is very simple. You just take a piece of the film and you observe the back of it, you will find that fixation is a diffusion-limited process, so that you can actually see the fixation start to take place if you look at the back of a piece of film in the fixer. And generally, for most films, the diffusion time is 15 to 20 seconds. After that, the fixer has completely diffused into the film, and now it's starting to diffuse products out of the film. So I run almost exactly the same test with the film, but I use as my starting point a little bit less than twice the time it takes to clear, and I go to twice that value, and I test it that way and determine the minimum fixing time and the minimum washing time. And then I keep the film around for a couple of months, usually hanging up in the darkroom on little clips, and I just watch them to see if they change color. And, of course, I've used the hypo test kits and the silver test kits on them. I have had all kinds of these little clips stuck to the wall in the darkroom. They're only about an inch square. The prints, on the other hand, are 4x5s with actual images on them, because I want to see also how good the quality of the image survives. So if the fixer is good for a print paper without hurting the image, then it certainly will be good for the film, which is much more resistant to any destruction of the image that might take place due to the fixer. That's basically how I test my fixer, and nothing could be simpler. It's just time-consuming. I do want to add that I don't test it with just one film. I usually test it with an Ilford and a Kodak film, and I test it with an Ilford and Kodak paper. I have a whole pile of old Polycontrast 4, one of the last batches Kodak made, and I've just been cutting it into 4x5 sheets and making prints on it. I have to say that for whatever reason, the Kodak paper fixes a lot more slowly than the Ilford does, but basically that's factored into all of the results. I also would like to add that, as with the developer, I also test the fixer with a reference fixer. And I use TF4, TF5, and Kodak Rapid Liquid Fix with and without hardener. That's my fixer test. My developer test is run with Dectol if I'm doing paper, and with D76 if I'm doing film. So that's how I test my films and papers, with different developers and fixer formulations. And I have bottles and bottles of other developers and fixers down here that I've bought at the local camera store. I keep them in business, you see. And I routinely do several tests. The only problem I have is that I can only do solution development or emulsion development work. I can't do both at the same time. It takes me about a week to convert my darkroom because it is so small. And I have to thank my wife so much. She keeps saying, "Why don't you just make a bigger darkroom? Take more of the basement." Now, isn't that a wonderful wife?
That is. Usually it's the other way around. Why don't you throw that darkroom away?
No, she's been urging me to take more of the basement up. So I've actually moved a lot of my chemical storage into a storage room and freed up some room in my darkroom. But it still takes about a week to convert back and forth. So if you said to me today, "Hey, how about doing me a new fixer?" Well, before I even start, I have to tear down all of my emulsion-making stuff to make room for the processing trays and everything like that. And then starting from scratch, I have to compound a fixer. And it takes about probably a month to come up with the formula that I want to your specification. And then it takes another month or so to come up with my specification of wash and fix rates, for example, for my water supply. And then I could use them as a baseline for giving you an instruction set, you see?
Sure. So, Ron, what's the progress now of the fixer development? You said you guys were at version 10. Is this a shipping product? Or are you guys still playing around with that because of the cost of some of the components?
We are still playing around with it because of the cost of several of the components, yes. But other than that, as I say, it's been tested. Several people have sent back comments that this is great, I like it, it works fast, it's easy to wash, and so forth. And that's where it's stuck right now. We're trying to find a supplier for one of the chemicals in particular that's extremely expensive. So I don't think you'll be seeing Superfix 9. We may have to go on to Superfix 10 with a new chemical ingredient to replace the other one.
Well, this one ingredient that's so costly, I mean, how much a difference are we talking cost of product versus the positive attribute that said chemical brings to the fixer? It must be worthy or you wouldn't have put it in the formula.
It works. I put it into the formula. It's not very toxic. It's used commercially, but it would run the cost up probably. I really don't know, but let me just use as a guesstimate. Let's say it might run the cost up 2 to 3 times the cost of an equivalent amount of Kodak Rapid Liquid Fix. Maybe 4 times the cost. I don't know. I haven't costed it out. I've let the people who know how to do it do that, you see. I have no idea what it actually would cost per gallon.
So with version 9, do you have works already in progress for 10 for different things that you want to try that you think people will want? Is there the ultimate fixer on the horizon? Not worried about cost. What would be the ultimate fixer, and it didn't matter what the chemicals cost?
Well, Superfix would be an ideal ultimate fixer, as it is, because it would allow that fixer to be used to compound the first truly workable Blix for color materials. So mixed with the appropriate chemistry, Superfix 9 would be also the basis for a color film Blix. But if I went on to Superfix 10, I would lower the cost, but I would have to sacrifice the ability to make it a universal fix. You see what I'm saying? It no longer would work with color film.
Right.
You can have one or you can have the other. Now, as far as Superfix 10 goes, Bill Troop and I have been exchanging notes, and we talk occasionally on the phone, and we're working up a list of chemicals that have the same generic chemical effect as this one costly ingredient. But it doesn't have all of the chemical effects. So there you are. We're stuck. As far as getting to work on it, I'm right now in the middle of a big emulsion project trying to get the book done. I'm on revision 5 of the book. I've got it printed out here with its first cover, too. I have a cover page on it now. And I've lined up 3 or 4 editors to work on it with me. I've gotten permission just yesterday, as a matter of fact, from Grant Haste to use portions of his book in mine. And I have to approach a few other companies to get permission to use a couple of charts and figures from Mies and Mies and James, plus a few others. So I still have to go through that. So I do have a rather full plate here. I'm not sitting back and twiddling my thumbs.
Very, very cool there. I mean, it's great to see that you're still working on the development, on fixers, on all kinds of things. And like you had mentioned earlier, that this has been going on now for, what, 120 plus years? And there's still ways to make a better fixer and a better developer and better chemicals and using different combinations to make a better product.
Yes, there is. There are 3 additional chemicals out there, 4 of them, that I can count that will accelerate the fixation reaction quite considerably. 5, if you consider one of the other ones that Bill and I are looking at, plus 1 that was used at Kodak and the formula is completely lost. It was custom made for one of my associates there. All I remember is the acronym that he used for it. It was HTTT, and it was one of the most active fixing agents I have ever seen. But in any event, there are, say, 5 fixing agents, and I've found that 3 of those work in concert with each other to give more than a doubling in fix rate. So you could count on maybe 100x fix rate improvement just by using these chemicals. You can also dilute the fixer more and have the old fix rate. So there's so much to do there. And many of these compounds are completely non-toxic. The problem is just ferreting them out in the literature. They're very well hidden in the literature. One of the ones that surprised us way back when was potassium iodide. If you use it in a fixer and it's too concentrated, just like potassium itself, it will stall fixation. But if you lower the concentration by about 10x, it accelerates fixation.
Really?
Yep. And so that surprise, we could never figure out why it happened, because when you're on a budget to get the job done, all you can do sometimes is show that something happens. And if it works and everybody else can show that it works, then you've got it made, you see?
Yeah. So, Ron, we have progression on the book and the DVD. Any other chemical projects that you're in the middle of that we can chat about next time?
Well, I haven't mentioned stop baths. Bill Troops told me there was a whole chapter on stop baths that got cut out of the original Anshel and Troop book I'd like to get back to. We could talk about hardeners.
I do want to talk about hardeners, so maybe next time we'll chat about hardeners because, like you said, you have fixers with and without hardener, and why do I need hardener? Should I harden this gelatin emulsion? I think that's a good way to move forward next is to talk about the hardener situation and maybe with stop bath as well.
Sure, whatever strikes your mind as being useful. I don't have anything new to add in the emulsion area because I think I mentioned to you the difficult time. It took 3 months to get one of the chemicals and another 3 months to get a supply of tubing, and then the emulsion didn't work out the way I'd expected because I couldn't achieve the mixing that I needed to get uniformity. So I've got quite a bit of work to do on several emulsions. I've got them written up, though, for the book. But it's going to take a while. I have a lot of emulsion work to do. I have, goodness, so many things to do. Even living on Mars would help a little bit. I'd get around faster with the lighter gravity, and I'd have another half hour in the day.
So, so true. Gravity's also getting to me, so I would definitely dig for less gravity.
Well, that's true. I'd have almost twice as many days in a year.
That's true. Ron, let's talk about where people can go to look at the current developers, fixers, and associated goodies that you've developed in combination with the formulary. And then, of course, I guess the best place to see what you're up to is really go to APUG, right?
Yeah, you can keep track of what I'm doing on APUB. You can see TF5 and Liquidol on the formulary webpage, which is down right now. They got no warning, apparently, and suddenly their hosting system said, oh, we're going to migrate you to our new operating system and webpage, and we're going to start tomorrow. And there was no warning at all. For some people, they are redirected to Fine Art Photo. Some people, like myself, are directed to an error page, and they're working very diligently to get their webpage back up. But yes, there is one fixer, there is one developer, and there are a pair of emulsions there, too, called Form Azo, which is the Azo emulsion that I make in two different grades, roughly grade 2 and a roughly grade 3. But since I didn't do any ANSI and fancy comparisons, I call them soft and medium.
Excellent stuff. Great to be able to chat about fixers and what they do and how you can continue to develop a new strain of these. I think one thing that's so cool about photography, and especially with your own development, nothing's hit the wall yet. There's possibilities for anything, and people can do all kinds of things, and you can play with stuff. It's very adjustable, and you can do whatever you want with photography. I think that's one thing that's so cool about analog capture and analog photography is you're not held back by anything.
That's true. As a matter of fact, I just sent Bill Troop recently a new generic, very high acuteness developer formula. It's a ballpark formula with a range of ingredients because we haven't tried it yet. And he was very excited about this entirely new application of ingredients. And I just don't have the time to get to it. It's going to be 3 or 4 months before I can do it. So we've got a high acuteness, fine grain developer formula hanging around here with a ballpark range ready to go as soon as I can get back to it. There is so much open yet. Analog photography has been dealt a vicious blow by digital much too early in its lifetime, if you know what I mean. There's so much more to do. I just wish I had the time to do it.
There's so much to learn, and you have so much knowledge to share, and we do appreciate it. And of course, congratulations on over 15,000 posts on APUG. Pretty amazing.
I was hoping you wouldn't mention that. I'll try to ignore it, because as one person put it almost quite rightly, almost 5,000 of those are trying to explain to people that PhotoFlow is not dish soap. Most dishwasher fluids are surfactants, but they also contain fragrance and color, which can't be left behind in the film without doing something nasty. Along with that, most dishwasher fluids are too strongly alkaline, and they're ionic. And PhotoFlow is non-ionic. Now, this isn't to say that an ionic surfactant is bad. It's just that you have to know which ones to use and what pH to use them at. And dishwasher fluid is certainly not the right thing to use. And just to add to that, you need some sort of a final rinse for every existing color film. And you must not wash after the final rinse, because you're rinsing out the goodie you put in the final rinse. The final rinse is effectively a stabilizer for your film. And probably the largest number of posts I've made are that and those about washing film and washing paper. And maybe we could do something about that sometime.
Still, 15,000 is an incredible amount, and I think it's so cool to see that you're sharing this knowledge with people. Even if it's talking to people about trying to use dishwashing liquid instead of buying the real thing, you're still conveying knowledge, and it's great to see that there's people like yourself that are still involved and want to share information. It's very cool.
Well, thanks, Scott. I really try to give the right information. Sometimes I miss the mark, but I'd like to remind people, if you want to do analog photography, you're doing chemistry. You're playing with chemicals. If you want to make substitutes for the known chemicals, you've got to know a little bit about what you're doing. And if I try to explain it and you ignore me, well, that's okay. But someday it can come back and bite you. And I would just say that the people don't have all of the information that they need. That's all. And that's what I'm trying to do, is give them information. But anyhow, let's leave it at that. And I guess we'll be talking again sometime soon, right?
We will. And people can also, like we said, go over to APUG and they can see what you're working on. They can check out the cool products that you've developed over at the Formulary, and there's a lot of stuff to chat about. We're going to be talking about other goodies in the development process and a lot of other cool stuff that we have going on here. So, Ron, I really appreciate you joining us today, and we look forward to chatting very soon.
Thank you. I appreciate your efforts, Scott, and I would like to thank all the people on APUG.
Well, there you go. Ron Mowry, photo engineer over on APUG, and an all-around great guy. This guy knows so much about the photochemical engineering of photography, He knows about photography. He was at Cape Canaveral. He was at Kodak for decades. He's got his name on many, many patents. There's a lot of people on the planet that know a lot of stuff, but not like Ron. Great, great guy. Definitely go over to www.apug.org. Check out his threads in the black and white forums, in the emulsion development, and a lot of great stuff going on with Ron. And of course, the products that he's developed over at The Formulary. Great stuff going on, Ron. Thank you so much. Looking forward to our next chat with Ron Mowry. The Inside Analog Photo Radio Program has been brought to you by Fujifilm for their full line of instant cameras and film, and of course, fine quality Fuji Crystal Archive paper over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. Our friends at Photo Publicist, worldwide publicity, strategic promotion, social media marketing, and business development over at www.photopublicist.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab for the finest quality lab in the country, richardphotolab.com. Our friends over at DR5 for black and white chrome at dr5.com. Upstrap for the finest quality camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder at upstrap-pro.com. Our friends over at Iger Studios at igerstudios.com. And of course, our media partners of the Analog Photography User Group at apug.org and our official philanthropic partner, George Eastman House, over at eastmanhouse.org. I've been your host, Scott Shepard, here on Inside Analog Photo. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.